This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Almost every second weekend, there is a steady stream of either hot rods, vintage cars or motorbikes of all shapes and sizes heading over the bridge at San Remo into Phillip Island to take part in often weekend-long events at the Phillip Island Grand Prix track. Yes, now it's lost that one event in October, the MotoGP, but the track is used far beyond that one weekend. You can even drive it yourself if you feel the urge. So what is the future now without this signature event? From motoring enthusiasts to the potential of music festivals, can the Grand Prix circuit in Phillip Island survive without the Grand Prix? And also coming up this hour, do bad reviews stop you from seeing a film?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So can the Grand Prix circuit in Phillip Island survive without the Grand Prix? Have you driven the track? And what is its future now without this signature event? Everything from hot rods to vintage cars to motorbikes, you name it, is held at that track. So now we don't have this one key event in October. Does it matter? Could you hold music events there? Would you go and see a gig there? We're seeing the lines blur between sporting and music events. Is this potentially a perfect place to stage music? As well, if you're a promoter, if you're an artist, I'd love to hear from you too. Trevor Hodge is the owner and editor of mcnews.com.au. Trevor, beyond the big event in October, how busy is this circuit in Phillip Island?
Oh, look, Rochelle, it's busy almost every day of the year. It's regularly booked out with various motorcycle ride days where general enthusiasts can ride their own motorcycle around the track or hire a motorcycle to ride around there. And it's much the same with various car clubs and car tuition, etc. So the circuit is flat out as it is now.
So I know that numbers surge in October, but the idea or the argument that Phillip Island will take a huge hit because it's lost this one event, do you believe that?
Oh, look, there's certainly something in that for some, but Cowes is pretty much bursting at the seams most weekends as it is now. So there will be an impact for sure, but I don't think it'll be an impact that will break the bank, so to speak, for most individual businesses. Perhaps some will have a severe impact, but I think overall, I don't think it'll make a massive impact to Phillip Island itself.
So given the key event, the MotoGP is now moving, I'm not sure how much money and import goes into the infrastructure from the organisation behind that event. Is there any concern from you that we will start to see a demise, just a general running down of infrastructure and upkeep, whether it be stands, whatever the facilities are there, without that one key event?
No, I don't think that'll be the case at all. I actually think this will spur the owners to really make those investments that perhaps they've been waiting to do so. I know there was a lot more slated to happen that was going to get underway as soon as this new MotoGP contract was finalised. But now that hasn't happened, they'll be spurred into action to try and retain the World Superbike event, which is actually this weekend. And that contract expires in 2027. So I think they'll do everything they can to try and retain that event. But, I think the investment will continue, and I actually think this might be somewhat of a rocket to really spur that along.
Mm. So the Superbike event is this weekend. Would there be any concerns? I mean, I've been in Phillip Island on the weekends that the superbikes are on. And let's just say you hear them coming. It is a very big and busy weekend. It's quite spectacular, actually. But would there be any concern that other big events would pull it as well because the MotoGP has been pulled?
Well, I don't believe so. No, I don't think there'll be any flow-on effect outside of the MotoGP itself. But, yeah, I'm sure they'll adapt, improvise and overcome. And like I say, I'm sure the Phillip Island Grand Prix circuit will still have a great future.
Have you driven it, Trevor?
Yes, I've driven it and ridden it many times. And it is very, very special ribbon of tarmac. It's quite unique in the world, and I think it's fair to say that this morning the motorcycling world of purists is in somewhat of a mourning.
So what's so special about it?
Just the flow of the circuit itself. Most modern circuits are very stop and go, and in motorcycling in particular, it's more about the flow. It's almost like a conductor in an orchestra. You've got to really caress the motorcycle around the circuit, and a circuit like Phillip Island is quite magical, the way it flows through sections like 2 and 3, out of Siberia, Hay Shed, across the famous Lukey Heights, and around the daunting 11 and 12. It's just an almost magical place, and it is quite unique. And I don't just say that through an Australian rose-tinted glasses. That's the story as seen around the world. It's for most motorcycle enthusiasts, if it's not number one, it's certainly wow. In every motorcyclists top three.
Let's hope it stays that way. Trevor, stay with us. Trevor Hedge is with you, owner and editor of mcnews.com.au. But Chris is in Pakenham. Morning, Chris.
Morning.
What did you want to say?
Well, given the very little coverage that it gets by the media during the year, I think it was inevitable it was going to go, because the only time the media takes any interest in Phillip Island is when, say, Casey Stoner or some other Australian.
Yeah, it doesn't get a lot of coverage, does it?
No. And like, I run a Facebook page in Pakenham for motorcycles, and I've got a little town like Pakenham's got 1,500 members in it. And we ride most weekends. It's a bit of a, you know, but Phillip Island's a mecca for motorcyclists, and they're coming through Pakenham from various directions on the way to the island, and it's gone unnoticed by mainly the media, but even the council trying to get something to welcome these riders.
So, Chris, given how often riders pass through all of the little towns heading in and around the Bass Coast to get to Phillip Island outside of that one weekend in October, do you think this is a huge loss to the island and to all of the little businesses along the way? I don't know, whether it be Grantville or Leongatha or Currumburra. Like, will those businesses still get a boost from groups like yours on every other weekend?
Well, not necessarily to the island, but yeah, you're right. All those little towns around the place, because believe it or not, the state of the roads. But
Victoria, that's a whole other conversation.
Victoria is a bit of a mecca for motorcycles, like the Great Ocean Road, the Great Alpine Road, and all those. Yeah, those back B roads, kind of in around the Gippsland area, South Gippsland, are a mecca for motorcyclists because
spoiled for choices, hey?
Well, yeah. Not spoiled, but yeah, just they need better road maintenance as well. But it's a mecca for motorcyclists that doesn't really get recognised.
Yeah, good to get your thoughts on this, Chris. Thank you, Trevor. Do you know what's interesting is that Chris is right. There's not a lot of coverage around the MotoGP, really, compared to other sports. And given the news, it's all been the, oh, my gosh, what a loss to Phillip Island. Everybody's a little bit devastated. However, I know a lot of people that live there, that spend time there, who don't love it, who actually hate it when the Grand Prix is on. So it's not as loved as what everybody thinks. There's a text here from Matt, and it says, "Hiya, I'm not a GP fan. I've basically given up going to the island and travelling to the island. It can just be horrendous due to the traffic. It's an island. I get that it's busy, but over those periods, it can take 4 to 5 hours to travel what would normally take me 2. My family time is too important to waste sitting in a car and in traffic jams to get to the island. It takes hours on end. I feel for the businesses in general due to this reason, however, losing the GP GP. But it's not universally, everybody's not necessarily upset that that event is gone.
No, obviously not. But I think that perception has changed amongst many over the years. I do remember there was somewhat of a backlash when the Grand Prix first went to Phillip Island. But I know as a punter and enthusiast that myself, that so many locals actually sit out the front of their house on Sunday evening and also Monday morning and actually wave and clap and wave flags, etc., as all the riders ride off the island to head back home. So, there's always probably going to be a few that perhaps are against motorsport in general and don't want that interruption to their lives, but I come to it from an enthusiast perspective, so I probably don't really understand that point of view.
Coming at it from a regional lens, how rare is it when you were talking about how unique the track is globally, how rare is it for that to be in a regional area?
Look, it's not that rare at all. Thailand's Grand Prix, for example, is at Mandalika, and that entails a boat ride for most people, and it's really very isolated, and it's similar at Balaton Park in Hungary. Obviously, due to noise constraints in this modern world, race circuits are generally not next to large suburban areas or cities because of the economics. The circuit has to be used all the time, which is very different than one weekend of the year. Okay, we're talking one weekend of the year for the Grand Prix, but to make the economics of running a circuit 365 days a year, it has to be in action almost all of those 365 days a year.
Yeah.
And you can't have that constant noise in adjacent to a city or suburb. So it just sort of makes sense. One thing follows the other.
But that would then, I guess, answer the question that I started with of can the Motor Grand Prix track survive without the Grand Prix? I would think then the answer is yes.
Oh, 100% yes. I mean, it's more seen of a loss by us motorcycle enthusiasts, yeah. I guess, just due to that unique nature of the circuit.
Having it there.
But,
maybe you can get it back, Trevor. You never know, right?
We will still ride it without the MotoGP.
That's it.
Myself and every other motorcycle enthusiast that enjoys racing.
Yeah, you're just not
going
to have all the big names and stars there. But you never know. Look, they might do a really bad job of it and we get it back, right? So you never know.
They might. Exactly. Fingers crossed.
You said it, not me. Trevor Hedge, the owner and editor of mcnews.com.au. Kate's in Newport. Hi, Kate.
Oh, good morning. I'm a motorcycle rider. I have been for decades now. I did a lot of my defensive driving, riding skills at Phillip Island, and many people do. It's just an iconic place, as Trevor said, but I don't think it's just about losing the MotoGP and the track will still be okay. That MotoGP is something very iconic to not only Australians but to international people. So you're going to lose a lot of people that travel from overseas, which bring in a lot of the tourist dollars. Mm. It's like saying losing the Australian Open in Melbourne and it goes somewhere else. Melbourne would be up in arms about it. The thing is, MotoGP and a lot of other motorcycle riding doesn't get the coverage because it hasn't got the big sponsors like the tennis. So
that must be frustrating. That's a really good analogy, Kate, to be like, okay, well, the tennis centre would still probably survive without the Australian Open, but we'd hate to lose the Australian Open, wouldn't we? Kate, thank you so much. I think that's a really good point. What about putting on music events there? I wonder, we're sort of seeing that line blur. So if it's not motoring enthusiasts, what about music enthusiasts, music lovers? Would you go and see a gig there? And is the current infrastructure, is it set up for music festivals?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Would you go and see a music event at the Phillip Island Grand Prix track? We're seeing that blur happen in between music and sporting events. We know that Guns N' Roses played the GPs in Adelaide, I think, or something, one of those particular events. I know I'm mincing my words there. But we're seeing the Speedway being used in Sydney. So could this track be used for music festivals? Fiona Duncan is the CEO of Music Victoria. Fiona, What do you reckon? Like, I'm trying to think what the infrastructure is like there, what the parking, what the camping facilities could be like. Could it be a music festival space?
Hi, Rochelle. Thanks for having me on today. Look, absolutely. You know, it's major infrastructure. And one of the biggest barriers to large-scale music events happening in regional Victoria is infrastructure. And Phillip Island now already has it ready to go. You know, it's built to host large crowds. It has transport, safety systems and facilities already in place. So it's perfectly positioned. And this is a little different from, it's actually the supercars that Guns N' Roses are playing at.
Oh, thank you. I knew it was something like that. I knew I was completely not stuffing it up.
No, but they have a concert as part of the event where this is like shared infrastructure where they have, you know, it's repurposing. So as you're saying, like Rod Laver, like Marvel, you know, it's repurposing a sport infrastructure to host other events. And it's,
Does one always get upset at the other? You know, where it's like when a music event is on at the MCG or at Docklands and then the next day there's soccer being played there and they're like, oh, the pitch isn't great. Or like, is there always one loses out? Can the two live side by side happily?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's it. You know, the technology and the teams involved are so professional. They can absolutely work. They can work to cover the pitch. You see that at the MCG where they have special coverage they can put over the turf. So to protect especially cricket is that I found the very sensitive around the pitch. But yeah, absolutely. They can work really well together. And they often do.
Is this the future, really, like looking at these big scale venues? When we look previously at music festivals, say, let's take Falls, for example, you go out and you cut a deal with a farmer who has a lot of land, you set up all the infrastructure, you have to pack it all up, there's impact to land and to habitat. The idea of actually using things like race circuits, MCG, sporting venues, it does make sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely makes sense. And it's well use of that investment that's already happened. Some events like to do a full greenfield build. They like to bring their whole infrastructure in because they wanted to create a design factor. But a lot of places really want infrastructure already in place. And as I said, it's a big barrier for regional major music events going into regional Victoria. It's infrastructure. So places that can offer infrastructure is a great opportunity to bring major events in.
Well, you would think it would bring your costs down, it would reduce your risk in some way, it would probably reduce your insurance overheads, your liability, all of those things that are becoming so problematic for music festivals.
Absolutely, absolutely.
How's the year looking for music, do you think, this year, Fiona, on another subject? Like, have we got a lot of big acts coming in locally? Are you confident that it's going to be a strong year for music?
Look, there's a lot going on in music and it's really buoyant. We're seeing really, you know, big, buoyant, big shows coming in. Victoria sells more major event tickets for music than any other state, which is great. We do have, you know, pressures on the grassroots level and we need to be very mindful of that because, you know, big music, big artists, they come from the grassroots, they come from those small stages. So we're really needing, going through this cost of living time, increased costs for trade, audience behaviour, they do need some support. So, but there are incredible artists coming through at all levels.
Would you go and see a gig? Would you go and see music at the Phillip Island Grand Prix track?
Absolutely. I used to go down there to Pyramid Rock and I go down there to Ocean Sounds today. Music is in the DNA of Phillip Island. It is very well placed to host major music events.
Fiona, thank you. Good to speak with you. Fiona Duncan is the CEO of Music Victoria. Dave's in Bendigo. Morning, Dave.
Morning. How are you going?
Really good. What do you want to say?
We were going for many years. A friend of mine, there's a big exhibition shed there. So when the Grand Prix was on, it was full of, you know, everything from boot stands, motorbike apparel, motorbikes. And then I used to work in his stand with him for years. And he stopped going the last few years because every year, and it kept dwindling every year because everyone, it just kept going up the cost so much. Like it just wasn't worth it. So he's just online now because he'd have to work for a day and a half before he even broke even. It just got out of control.
Right. So those who were so-called making money from that particular event just weren't.
No, not in the end, it just wasn't worth it. Like I said, you only get 3 days there really with the crowd. and a day, day and a half before you even started to make anything, you know, it just was out of control. That's what dwindled so much.
And does he do any other events there over any other period of the time other than in October?
Yeah, he used to do the super bikes and then the classic one and all that, but he started stopped doing that too, like a lot of them did. They, you know, and you get to talk to all the people on the stands and they're all in the same boat. They just couldn't afford to do it.
It's interesting, Dave. Do you think it's a big loss?
The other way. Yeah, well, it's funny. I look at it the other way too. Been going for years and we plan our trip. We ride the bikes down. He takes a van and, you know, you do your Currumburras, your Three Peaks, Falls, Omeo. It's amazing. But I actually look at it the other way and I'm already thinking I can't wait with the boys to plan the trip to Adelaide for something different.
Ouch.
I know, but I do. Even as I look at the motorbikes themselves and I'll get to see a bit more of the different country I've never got to see, I suppose.
Yeah, not alone. There's quite a few people saying I'm planning my Adelaide trip.
Yeah, and it's the same. Like when you're at Melbourne talking to all the people in the stand, you do not realise how many people come from around Australia. So I don't think people from Queensland, you know, they've just got to have to plan a nice little, see some different countries, little towns they haven't seen on the way to Adelaide.
Oh, Dave, harsh but fair.
Exactly.
Good on you, mate. Thank you.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And it's interesting, the conversation that started on the text line around the merging of sporting events and music festivals and using sporting infrastructure to stage music festivals, given how expensive it is and whether or not one misses out. If you have a big event on, if you have Taylor Swift play, for example, the next day, what's the ground like? If you had to play footy there the next day, would it be up to scratch? And who wins at the end? There's a text here that says, you didn't hear it from me, but Docklands, apparently footy gets in the way of concert season. That's how they activate it, to make money all year round. Yeah, well, I wonder what does bring in more money, whether it's the sport or whether it's the arts. Now, there's a little fight to start. Now, you might have heard the term peptides, right? So you may have heard that bandied around over recent years. If you open up any kind of beauty magazine or you follow any beauty influencers, you'll see peptides referred to as the superheroes of skincare. But more recently, there's been concern around the growing market for injectable peptides and just how easily they're accessed. Timothy Patowski is a senior research fellow at the University of Queensland and specialises in image and performance enhancing drugs. Timothy, we've spoken to you on and off over the years about steroids, but of late, your focus has been on peptides. Now, I thought peptides were just something that were in serums for your skin that you paid a lot of money for. However, there is a growing and scary world of injectable peptides. So what are peptides?
Sure. So look, these are, like, technically speaking, fundamental building blocks of proteins like collagen, elastin, keratin, and they're, you know, naturally occurring, but I think what we're talking about and what we're concerned with mainly are synthetic peptides that people are injecting into their body, like you said. So unlike, you know, something that you put on your skin or something that's absorbed topically, a lot of websites have come up selling Chinese research chemicals, not for human purposes, that are these synthetic peptides, so things like human growth hormone, GHKU, BPC-157, you might have heard of some of these. And sometimes they combine them into, you know, like the glow pack, which is meant to be...
So why are they injecting them? Is it for the same reasons that people inject steroids? Is it to build muscle quickly excessively, or is it for skin glow? Like, why are people injecting them?
Yeah, look, I think unlike previously where we just had this, you know, really homogenous group of people that, you know, use these types of enhancement drugs for performance and aesthetics, we've got all kinds of people calling us on Steroid Connect. And as I've mentioned previously, you know, this ranges from 14, 15-year-olds all the way through to parents and carers. As well as people asking for advice on how to inject and what to use and I think the purposes are now, you know, wanting to look better, wanting to recover from an injury, and of course, you know, wanting to tan, et cetera, et cetera. So just a real variety of people.
Wow. So the mind boggles around whether or not people even know what they're injecting and the harms that can be caused. How dangerous is this?
Look, so we're currently in the midst of expanding my world first steroid checking program, Roid Check, to include more and more performance enhancing drugs. So peptides are on the cards, and we're currently developing and working with a few partners to do that. And we'll be looking to run a trial pretty soon so that we can present to everyone exactly what's in them. And if you remember from my trial, steroids in particular, from last year collectively, one in six was the right. Sorry, one in six was the wrong steroid, but only one in 10 was the right dose. So
I could imagine the harms if you don't know what you're taking. Everything from death to heart issues, you name it, could
Correct.
Be
Correct.
Problematic with injecting something that you've purchased off the internet.
Imagine if it had some toxic mold or some staph.
I don't want to imagine that. Oh, my goodness. So, Tim, I want to talk in just a moment about Steroid Connect, which you just mentioned, which is like a hotline, right, an information line that people that can call if they're concerned, if they have questions, if they want information. The ease in which people, young people, old people, you name it, are getting these peptides delivered to their door. I know people have rung your hotline. Parents, for example, who have been home, maybe working at home during the day, and all of a sudden, ding dong, the door goes and there's a little box of something incredibly dodgy that's been delivered for their son or daughter at the door. How much of an issue is that?
Look, I think we've unfortunately left this by the wayside as a public health issue for a really long time. And so now we're, you know, trying to operate reactively to something that's existed. We've had social media networks and influencers promoting these things for a long, long time. And so we've also got a huge ease of access. We could go online right now and we could order something to your door within 48 hours. It would be there and you could start using it. Quite often the needles used to inject these subcutaneously, you can also order from the same site. And unfortunately, what that does is take away that potential for a health conversation to occur with a health worker. So people won't necessarily attend somewhere like a needle and syringe program, or they might not attend.
Right, because what they're doing is dodgy, so they don't want to talk to people about it.
Yeah, so when they call Steroid Connect, it's actually really good. We've got an ex-bodybuilder who's also a social worker, Sonia. She works closely with me, and people can call the line and ask questions. Sometimes it's parents.
It's almost like pill testing, but on the phone.
Yeah.
It kind of is, yeah. So if influencers, the amount of trouble that they cause, I mean, seriously, how do you stop that? If someone is health washing, body washing someone around injectable peptides, can those sites be brought down quickly? I mean, is there any way of monitoring this safely?
Look, this is being done and sites pop up and get taken down all the time. But imagine that on a scale of, you know, tens and hundreds, thousands. Rather than, you know, one or two. And so I don't think that's really a good response. What we should be doing is providing open and transparent health literacy for people to be able to understand what they're doing. And I think these are two ways that we do it well, is providing people with objective data about, like, what they're putting in their bodies and showing them that it actually isn't and it's terrible. And then, you know, explaining to them that there's other levers that they can pull to get the results that they want.
So, Tim, if a parent is listening and they've answered the door to find a box delivered and they're concerned about maybe what their child is taking, if someone started to take something that they thought was legitimate. Are these people who can call Steroid Connect and yes. speak openly and honestly?
Yes. Yes, we welcome those types of calls.
And how often is it stationed? Like how often will someone pick up the phone?
So someone's there from 9 till 4 every day, Sonia. And if she's busy on the phone or delivering training or something, she'll call you back. So full time.
And the research that you're currently conducting, Tim, what would you like done with it?
Look, I think we are already, you know, expanding RoidCheck nationally and trying to include more substances like peptides. I think peptides is a really emerging concern. And I think it will be really, really great to get that information out there and show people. What we've seen with RoidCheck is when you present people with the information about their steroids and show them how terrible they are, and then you pair that with a health intervention, we find that there is a significant difference. 84% of people intend to change their health behaviours after we do the RoidCheck intervention. Versus, I think, 22% of people who just see the results online and don't do the intervention. So it really works.
When you get your next round of research, make sure you keep us up to date and we'll have another chat.
Will do.
Thank you. Good on you, Tim. Thank you. Dr. Tim Piatkowski, who's a senior research fellow at the University of Queensland, who researches and specialises in performance-enhancing drugs. Wow, it's frightening, isn't it? We've also been talking about the loss of the MotoGP in Phillip Island, but it turns out there are events on, if not every second weekend, every weekend. So does it matter? Is it about the international people that come and visit? Glenn's in Baxter. Morning.
Oh, hey, Rochelle. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Just listening to your conversation before with the lady in regards to repurposing the track possibly for a concert.
For music music festivals, yep.
Yeah, music festivals, that's right. So I've pretty much been attending the GP pretty much every year since its inception. Very sort of shocked to hear it's going. But just knowing the track pretty well back to front, it's not really a track that you could have a concert in. It's very undulating and up and down. That's why it's such a magnificent track and so challenging for the riders. There's a possibility that I could have it in the paddocks next door to the track, but the lady sort of spoke about, you know, there's transport and infrastructure and everything else. Well, anyone who's sort of been down to the GP knows that transport's not really that great.
No, there's like a V-line bus.
Yeah, so, I mean, they could really, if I'm talking about concerts and things, they could really have them in any paddock sort of around the area. As opposed to the track itself. But and I was just sort of wanting to say I don't really understand the decision. I heard the sports minister before talking about how this all came about, and he said that they basically ticked off the checklist to appease Dorna, but the last one was that they wouldn't move it to Albert Park to make it a street race. Well, I don't understand that because, I mean, Albert Park, obviously, it's not equipped at all for a MotoGP race, especially. But there's so many F1 and GP races around the world that have F1 and GP, but no other, as far as I believe, no other city's been asked to hold a street race. So I don't understand why they singled out Victoria or Phillip Island.
So did you believe a lot of what you were told? Because there was a lot of information that came out early in the week from the state government, yet people in Phillip Island didn't really know what was going on. They were like, really? You know, we were the ones that told them. And then the state government went quiet. They didn't say anything until they made their announcements yesterday with the story behind it. What did you read into that?
Well, probably the more I think about it today and the more I hear from the Phillip Island locals and everything else, I mean, Victoria's in a pretty precarious position, aren't we, with our debt and whatnot. And I honestly do believe it's just a cost-cutting measure. I think they've just probably easier to wipe their hands of it. I know it brings in $60 million, but I can only imagine what it would cost to actually sort of keep funding an event like this. And the crowds have been dropping over the years. There's no doubts.
Lots of people have been saying that. So why are the crowds dropping? Was it purely cost, Glenn?
I think to a certain extent, there's enthusiasts, no matter what the cost. I think the motorcycle fraternity will always get out and support it. But just over the years, as one caller sort of pointed out, they've just sort of been cutting things over the years. Like as far as entertainment goes, you used to go there and they'd have sidecar events, they'd have F-18s instead of like propelled roulettes doing the stunt shows. In between the races, they'd have stunt bikes come out on the tracks, and they'd always keep you entertained. And just over the years, they've obviously, yeah, cut costs, and a lot of the there's a lot of dead time in between races. And I think I know from some of my friends and my family, you just sort of find it a bit boring now. You're waiting so long in between races.
Yeah,
so
why am I here? Stayed in line to get there. So no love lost for you, Glenn. Will you head to Adelaide?
Oh, look, it's going to be hard. There is a lot of love lost. I don't begrudge Adelaide for doing what they're doing. It's sort of the way of the world now. But, geez, it's such a beautiful place and a beautiful location, and always was such a bit of a spiritual journey down there every year. So
to get to Phillip Island.
Get to Phillip Island, especially on the bikes, you know.
Lots of people have said that it's actually the ride there, you know, whether depending on which way you drove through, you know, if you go in and through South Gippsland or whichever direction you're coming from, that it was a bit of a spiritual journey to get there. That breaks my heart a little bit. That sounds like the classic, it's the journey, not the destination.
Yeah, spot on, Rochelle, spot on. And probably the ride at the end of it's more fun than anything. It's a bit like Mad Max out on the roads after the race, you know. Everyone gets the red mist on, so to speak.
Good on you, Glenn. Oh, well, I hope you have lots of beautiful rides anyhow. Take care.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So if you actually decide to go and see a film at a cinema, right, so not download it, not watch it at home, if you decide to go and spend money, because it's not cheap to go to the cinema these days, do you read the reviews first? Once upon a time, I know I sound 1,000 years old, you'd look at the reviews. You'd be like, right, what's getting good reviews? Now, who writes the review? Where do the reviews come from? What constitutes a review? And even if a film gets a shocker, gets a really bad review, does it make a difference to whether or not you go and see it? So Wuthering Heights, terrible reviews, like 2 stars a lot of people were giving it. However, at the box office, through the roof. Didn't matter whatsoever. Liam Burke is an associate professor in cinema and screen studies at Swinburne University. Liam, that relationship between a good or bad review, but let's say a bad review, and whether or not people go and see it, is that just a thing of the past?
Certainly the idea of the traditional critic. We think of the idea of, you know, David and Margaret when at the movies. We think of, you know, the journalists. That's less relevant to modern audiences. They look to review aggregators. So the most famous one being Rotten Tomatoes, which will aggregate all the reviews and assign a percentage. So currently, Wuthering Heights is deemed rotten on Rotten Tomatoes because the overwhelming consensus is that it was not that good. But it's sort of an imperfect binary because it's a polarizing film. Some people hate it, some people are all in, very few 3-star reviews. But as you rightly point out, the audiences don't seem to care.
No.
In fact, Rotten Tomatoes has a popcorn meter where the audiences can put their review and has a much healthier 78%.
What I find tricky to understand now is, like you're saying, whether it's, say, David or Margaret, you know, whether there were reviewers that you would follow in The Green Guide, in The Age or whatever, or Rotten Tomatoes, you had who you followed, who you knew to be a film reviewer. That's just got so weird and murky now, whether it's just someone on social media, you've got, you know, famous people like Melania, Trump. What even constitutes a film review or a film critic now?
Well, that's quite interesting as well with Rotten Tomatoes. They have widened their pool to not just include traditional print critics, but influencers, podcasters. And the argument is that if you want to get positive word of mouth for your movie, you can kind of flood the zone by having preview screenings that are influencer heavy, and you can put an embargo on traditional press. And so the influencers will get to go, and they'll go to like a Barbie screening, and Margot Robbie will be there, and they're given lots of, you know, food and drink, and it's a big event, and they'll give, you know, they'll have really positive word of mouth, and that, and then the embargo lifts and maybe the more traditional critics have a more measured response.
That's terrible. So the influencers get all the champagne and all the fancy stuff, and then the people with that have an actual skill don't get anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is the thing. And you get to be, you know, whether, and it's not just blockbuster movies, but certainly you would think of the latest Marvel movie or video game adaptation. You get a bunch of fans together. You give them that opportunity to interact with maybe some celebs. How could you not go away with a very positive view of the film?
Even if it's great.
It is somewhat mediocre. And so Rotten Tomatoes really has sort of supplanted the traditional critic. But I looked at Wuthering Heights yesterday and it was fresh, and now it's gone rotten by a margin of just 1%. It went from 60% to 59%. I think that's where the nuance is lost. So you don't get the sort of the measured connection to the source material, past adaptations, where it fits in, you know, comparison to other entries in the genre. Is it good? Is it bad? And that can be somewhat limiting.
The idea, I know, during elections, during budget lockups, of letting influencers into what was once, you know, very strict criteria of who you were and what news organisation you worked with. I wonder whether they're going to start to let influencers in early to those events and give them the better sandwiches. You know, it's going to be tricky to know. Talk to me about Letterboxd. So I don't know too much about Letterboxd, but this is, from what I believe, another emerging review type platform. Is this of any influence?
Yeah, absolutely. So Letterboxd is been around for about 10 years. It started in New Zealand, but it really gained attention during the pandemic. It's a film discovery site. So every time you watch a movie, you would put in a little review and the star rating, and it became kind of the cinephile, the real film buffs, platform of choice, not Rotten Tomatoes, not IMDb. And that's become kind of the cool cinephile one. So where the top 250 in IMDb might be filled with, you know, Marvel movies or kind of obvious sort of categories, you look to Letterboxd and it'll be, you know, foreign language film. It's very much a discovery site, and they're really strong on socials, Instagram and TikTok. So even if people don't really know what Letterboxd is, they'll be familiar with the four favorites, where they'll stop celebs on, you know, the carpet and ask them what are their four favorite films. So it becomes this sort of rebuttal to the Rotten Tomatoes,
right,
popcorn-o-meter, where it's a slightly more measured, slightly more cinephilic, slightly more in tune with film history approach is kind of a corrective.
Which sort of gives me some hope, because after talking to you about this, Liam Burke is with you, an associate professor in cinema and screen studies at Swinburne University. Being a critic and the art of critiquing, like, it's a skill. It's something that you learn. It's something potentially that you learn at university. Is that world just being lost and swallowed up by randoms on the internet?
Well, we all love a hot take and, you know, something that's kind of clickbait. But, and, you know, there'll always be those kind of headlines, you know, Wuthering Heights is unfaithful to the book. But what you want is someone who's kind of steeped in film history and can say, well, actually, if you go back to the Laurence Olivier version, that left half the book out too. So it's contextualized. It's not, you know, this kind of hot take. Having said that, there is a wave of really good film criticism online, on YouTube, on social media, and particularly in podcasts. So you think of podcasts like the, you know, the Rewatchables, The Town, The Business, some of whom have made it to video podcasts and are now on Netflix, and they've become sort of the new where we previously would look to David and Margaret. That's where we're getting the kind of slightly more in-depth, slightly more conversational film criticism that we used to enjoy in previous eras from print and traditional broadcast.
It's interesting. There's this text that says, similar case in point, Melania, universally panned by critics, but high Rotten Tomatoes ratings. It must all depend on who's willing to go on a line and write a review or rate a film. But whether or not it's critics or just the general public's view, it's always and always will be subjective. Margaret Pomerantz once reviewed a film lovingly. It was a film that I walked out on because it was just so boring. So there's a lot of truth in that as well, really. It's totally subjective.
Absolutely. The Melania example is particularly interesting. So that documentary, which was funded by Amazon to, you know, an inordinate sum for a documentary, has an 11% critics consensus on Rotten Tomatoes, but the audience score, the popcorn meter, as they call it, is 98%. So you've got 80-odd percent difference between what the critics think and what the audience think. So it is obviously super serving a very particular audience. Obviously, there's a political element there, but you could think of something like fans of a particular star, like Jacob Elordi fans, you know, for Wuthering Heights, or maybe a particular video game or comic book that's being adapted. And they can often sort of kind of, again, go on socials and inflate a particular opinion. And that does lead to a certain amount of gatekeeping and what's called review bombing. You might remember 10 years ago, there was an attempted Ghostbusters film that had an all-women cast.
Yes.
And certain people, because certain people would always disappoint you, decided that that was a bad thing. And before they had even seen the film, before they could see the film, they were flooding platforms like IMDb, like Rotten Tomatoes, with negative reviews of the film, purely based on the casting. And Rotten Tomatoes came up with measures to try and circumvent that. So now there's a verified audience where you have to prove you've seen the film in order to provide a review. But those tend to be band-aid solutions. And so people with very particular baked-in views can often sort of mire a film or praise a film disproportionate to its actual quality.
That's made me want to go out, and I totally forgot that there was an all-female Ghostbusters film, and now I'm going to go and try and find it and watch it. And I think what I've learned from today is if you're going to see a film to review, tell them you're an influencer and to get all the good stuff, basically.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Liam. Liam Burke, Associate Professor in Cinema and Screen Studies at Swinburne University. We've been talking all morning, as everyone has pretty much, as to what we stand to lose given now that Phillip Island has lost the MotoGP. This, as a motorcycle rider who's ridden Phillip Island many times, that track is unique and amazing. However, the overall facility is outdated. It's lacking services. It doesn't have the hotel accommodation on site for the MotoGP teams. This is where the new MotoGP races will be held in South Australia. It's a great track. I ride that track too. It has amazing and everything there, plus more. I'm not surprised that the race is going to that particular track. Aaron Lofts is a classic car expert and auctioneer from Slattery Auctions. Aaron, I know that we've got the superbikes this weekend. There's hot rods. There's all sorts of classic and vintage car meets and races which are held at that track. As a classic car expert, how do you feel about the news over the last week?
Oh, look, it's certainly frustrating to hear that MotoGP will be leaving, because that is a world-class event that brings the best bikes and the best riders around the planet to our shores. But it's not like the track's gathering dust. There's historic motoring events there quite often. There's also other categories of racing like the GT World Series that runs there. It's been a little while since the supercars have raced there, but it is possible that that can happen again. But it is a big shame.
So with some people like that text that I just read out saying, you know what, the facilities are kind of outdated, that the infrastructure is starting to get a little bit tired. Is that just specific to really big international events? Would you say that for a classic car, for a vintage car event, are the facilities up to scratch?
Oh, absolutely they are, for a day sort of event. Yeah, I mean, I think that those events, the island itself has plenty of ways to house accommodation. But yes, the Bend is pretty impressive with its trackside hotel. Same with Bathurst in New South Wales for the motor racing. So if you were to re-attract a world-class event, I think they're the sort of things that you would have to have in order to make that happen.
How do those old, I look at some of the old classic cars, and there's nothing more impressive when you're driving in or out of Phillip Island and there is just a stream of vintage cars that are coming in, and you know that something exciting's happening out at the track. But they're so different, right? Those old cars, just how they're built, how they sit on the road. How do they take the bends versus, say, some of the superbikes?
Oh, well, certainly a little bit slower. it's an amazing sort of thing to watch. I mean, the historic racing at Phillip Island is great. You get to see all these cars from yesteryear, and particularly some of the cars that were sort of made in backyards rather than in these, you know, multi-million dollar engineering workshops. It is quite a sight to see and a really good window into where we've come from and where we've evolved.
You always see people, no matter the weekend, even if it's just everyday people people like myself, which I've never done, I never would, but if you can be anyone and you can pay to drive that track, and there's always someone standing on the outside near the fence and looking in. Aaron, have you ever ridden the track there? What's it like?
I have not. It's on the bucket list. I would love to take my classic car around the track at some point, and I'm sure that opportunity will be there. But it is something that I know other people who have, both on bikes and cars, and it is just picturesque. The cliff, the ocean, it's a beautiful place.
Just take those corners slowly.
Well, that sort of takes the fun out of racing as quickly as you can, I suppose. Otherwise, you're going to end up in the sand.
Yeah, absolutely. Just slower. Aaron, good on you. Thank you. Aaron Lofts, who's a classic car expert and auctioneer. Liz has just sent this saying, I love the female Ghostbusters films. I've watched it several times. Hilarious. All right, Liz, I'm going to try and convince the family that we watch that on the weekend. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.